Hello and welcome to the Fast Break Podcast. This is Aman Kidwai. I am joined by Patrick Martin and Dan Madigan. We are back from Phoenix, folks, after bringing home another ship. The UConn Huskies win their sixth ever national championship after beating Purdue. As George Costanza said about designing a wing at the Guggenheim, it wasn't that hard either. The Huskies won all six of their games, keeping the streak alive at 12 of wins by 13 or more points in the NCAA tournament. They're one of the most dominant teams of all time, one of the best teams ever. We also had two or three folks in Phoenix to take in the events, including Patrick Martin. Patrick, our Midwest correspondent, getting the chance to travel the globe to parts unknown, including Glendale, Scottsdale, outer Phoenix, and many other outer boroughs. Patrick, how are your travels? Give us your correspondence. What was Phoenix like? And seeing wins over Bama and Purdue like that in the Final Four and championship to win it all.
First of all, it was so funny to see anyone you introduced me as we were rubbing elbows. And once you said the Midwest correspondent, everyone's reaction was like, ooh, oh, so where are you from? And it legitimately dropped me down a peg in these people's eyes, which hurt the soul.
I disagree. But I think they said, oh, wow, Midwest correspondent, Cincinnati Bureau, like very serious operation you've got here, Aman. Hey, congratulations.
Come out to the Cincy office and see how we do things over here.
Yeah.
But no, it was amazing. For me, it was a full circle moment because I had been in Glendale at that stadium with the Bengals back in 2015. So 9 years later, I was down on that field. The Bengals lost like a last minute game. And I remember being so captivated by that dome. I've never been in a dome before. And the high 60,000 crowd, just thinking like, wow, this is really something. And then to 9 years later, rush in Saturday late, might I add, because the NCAA didn't really mark where our credentials were.
Late for being early, Tom Coughlin, just to clarify. We were not actually late. We were there for the game.
No, we were late for the first game, so we didn't get to see any DJ Burns. Bummer about that. You know, I finally sold my shares. It was a great ride. Shout out to the walking refrigerator with ballerina feet. But yeah, it was such an amazing feeling to see all of this come together, and a remarkable weekend for not only how the team played, but the how they did it versus, you know, really struggling at times against Alabama. Again, locked in a war in each half between Bama and then Purdue. Not sure if this is like the coronation of Zach Edey or not. Is this another version of Virginia coming back and winning it all? You know, all these conflicting narratives. And at the end, none of it mattered. And I spent all year, you guys, quietly like holding my takes a little bit. Like, yeah, you know, we're really good, but you never know because variance in March is so crazy. You never know what's going to happen. There are so many really, really sick teams that just fall victim to the Frank Kaminsky's of the world. You know, 2015 UK comes to mind. And it doesn't matter. No, this team will never lose again at this point, to quote Shorzy. And I can't wait to get into what it means and the levels at which this team has reached. And it's I still can't believe it, to be, you know, and then to walk onto that court and, you know, tease Khalid El-Amin about, can you guys beat this team? Oh, yeah, for sure. Jake Voskal gets clinging in foul trouble in the first half and, you know, gives me a big hug. Rudy Gay talking about how it's like, oh, man, like, you know, if it wasn't for George Mason, we would have been right up in there. Rip Hamilton being classy as always. Emeka Okafor being like, all these guys around just to join in on this team. It's remarkable. I don't know. I mean, it's been a rough Wednesday, Thursday, Friday for me right now. And I'm sure, Amon, you feel the same way. Dan, I mean, like, you watched it. I'm sure you're feeling the come down. But to be down the court, seeing Klingon just stand up, cutting the nets, the one shining moment, it was an unforgettable experience, probably a top five moment of my life.
Yeah, I was, you know, wasn't in Phoenix this year. I was fortunate enough to catch the Huskies in Houston last year. And I feel like the thing that stuck out for me about the whole experience, Patrick, was seeing how that whole UConn family, alumni, come back. They're all going nuts in the front row. They're going just as crazy as all the other fans that are there. And I think it just speaks to the program. And I feel like that's really hard to do, right? This is UConn's third head coach in the last 20 plus years. And there's still that culture kind of bridging the gap back to the old Calhoun days. And it's really bigger than even like Calhoun or Hurley or Ollie. Like it's really just UConn kind of above everything else. And I don't think that's the case for other schools. And I just think it's really cool to see. I always remember, I always tell anyone when I went to the Final Four, like we were in the same section, 80 rows back behind like Ray Allen, Emeka Okafor, all those folks. Every time, you know, Ray Allen would come up, go to the bathroom or get a beer or whatever, the entire UConn section would stand up and clap no matter what. It was middle of the game, under eight timeout or whatever. Just like, let's go, Ray. Let's go. You're a legend. Like just so much respect for those guys. And it's just really cool to see them all kind of show out and support the team. But coming back to this year, I mean, it's just an unbelievable run. I kind of feel the same way that you did, Patrick. Like, this team certainly was capable of losing a game, but I just wanted to see someone do it. Like, it, you know, picking them for brackets, picking them with buddies or whatever. I was kind of in the camp that I need to see someone do it with my own eyes for 40 minutes before I'm to say this team can be beat or so-and-so can beat this team. And honestly, Mark Sears tried his best to do it for Alabama. I thought that Alabama team was really impressive, made a lot of shots. Sears seemed like he was bottled up all game. He still had 24, 27 points. He was unreal. And Estrada was great as well. And then in the championship game, it makes sense knowing what the game plan was for Hurley, for Murray, for the rest of that coaching staff. But it was very concerning to see Edie just come out so hot in those first 10 minutes. I remember a bunch of my buddies were texting me like, oh, Edie looks unstoppable. Like, this is going to be a problem. And it really did look like that for the longest time. And credit to the coaching staff, to Donovan Klingon, to the rest of the starters for kind of sticking to that game plan, not panicking, and just kind of letting things take its course. Because things could have gotten really, really off the rails once Samson Johnson got in foul trouble and Klingon had to play 30-plus minutes or whatever he ended up playing. And instead, they kind of just toughed it out, figured it out, grinded through it, and they were able to come out on top. So the game plan was executed perfectly. It's just another great scout by Murray, by good work by Kamani Young, those guys. And it really, at the end, it was a pretty comfortable win. I feel like once UConn got past the under eight timeout second half, maybe like 6 minute mark, it was a lot of like going back and watching that game again. It was a lot of letting Edie score. He probably had 10 or 12 essentially garbage time points to kind of pad the stats a little bit, but just a really impressive performance. I think it's really without saying this is the greatest UConn team of all time. And I know we'll probably talk a little bit, unpack that legacy a little bit more later, but Patrick, I was curious what your thoughts were on all that.
Luke Murray said after the game, he's like, look, that was the plan. We were okay with letting Edie establish his position early, get some baskets, get all pumped up, because even though he was still scoring at ease, he had to work in established position. And I think the bet was that UConn has someone in a 7-2 Klingon that could eventually wear him down. And even though Edie had played, you know, 30, 40 minutes every game, he had never battled someone like Klingon. And if you just shut off all the other options, like UConn did, eventually he's going to get a couple misses, and then you find yourself up 4 or 5 like they were at the half. Then you come out and hit a 3 right at the break. And as long as you take away Purdue's spurt ability, aka like the Evan Maya kill shot, there was no chance they were getting back into that game. We were talking like I thought that was over the second that hit 13 points, because Purdue was not getting back into the game, trading, just go down, waste 25 seconds, throw the ball into Edie, and go. They couldn't afford to play a different style pace, and UConn was content with that. They went small ball for what, 2 or 3 minutes? Okay, fine. We're going to spread the court on the other end and kill some clock as well. Once you gave – and that's why I was never really worried about Purdue, because once you got some separation from them, they weren't going to shoot their way back into it if you shut off – you run them off the three-point line the way UConn did. That's easier said than done, but as I had said before in the preview, like, this wasn't an Alabama team that had – athletic dudes that can, you know, get to the rim and get by UConn's defenders just based off foot speed. This was, you know, they didn't, you know, Foster Lawyer ain't dry, you know, blowing by Cam Spencer. Steph Castle put Braden Smith in a body bag, as everyone else that he did. You know, Mark Sears got his, but he really had to work for it. And a lot of that was when Castle, you know, kind of was in foul trouble towards the end of that Alabama game. So you just had to trust and say, okay, like, this support, like, I was so sick of hearing that Purdue supporting cast is so much improved. It's like, well, no, it wasn't. They still stunk when it came down to it. So I felt good that, like, with that game plan of, like, all right, you know, let Edie get his. That's great, because he's still not that much better than Kling, in that even though he looked so good in the beginning, it was going to eventually even out.
Yeah, I just was so surprised that – I guess I wasn't surprised that Edie kind of wore out, because I think going against someone of his similar size was going to be something that took its toll on him throughout the course of the game. I still don't understand why Edie played 40 minutes against NC State and then had to come back on, you know, 1.5 days rest to play later. That game was I guess it looks a little closer than the final score really says, but – that game was over by the under eight timeout. NC State had given up. The Magic had run out, unfortunately, but that's just what happened. And I feel like I was a little shocked that Painter didn't try and steal an extra 6 to 8 minutes of rest for a 7'4", 300-pound guy who has a game in less than 48 hours and, you know, has the potential to play someone that's 7'2", 7'3", similar weight. So that was something that I really didn't understand and haven't really seen an answer as to why that's the case. I know that's how you got there. You got to ride the guy that got you there. But I also was just so surprised that when the lead got as big as it got, Patrick, like you said, when it got to 13 and it was just Edie killing time and trying to score a bucket in the post, Painter really doubled down on that. I think there was a media timeout, talked with the sideline reporter, and he said, like, yeah, Edie's our guy. We're going to keep going to him for buckets. Like, we're going to try and kind of ride him as long as we can. And the stubbornness of the coaches against UConn really just surprised me. I think Underwood said something really similar, like, we'll go at Klingon 100 times. If he blocks 99, we'll keep going or whatever. And I feel like Hurley, for his credit, is a lot more flexible with that stuff. If he sees something that isn't working, he's always willing to change it up and try and exploit an advantage. And that stubbornness for Purdue really kind of changed the end of the game for them. I feel like they made a concerted effort to try and get more open threes or more open looks for other players. Granted, it was hard to come by, but I feel like that could have changed the game a little bit. But the defensive game plan was just too good. I saw that per Synergy Sports, I think Purdue had two points on spot up shots for the entire game. It's usually their entire bread and butter outside of Edie on offense. So everything was executed perfectly. Incredible defense from Alex Caravan, Cam Spencer, Steph Castle, Hosan Diarra on the perimeter. And that's what happens. I mean, when a team this good is executing, they are really hard to beat. But I was surprised that Purdue didn't do more to try and kind of go all in with their season on the line and a chance at history to try and beat this Huskies team.
I know he didn't have the personnel for it necessarily, but it was also insanely comforting, honestly, to watch Purdue burn 20 seconds on the clock with like 12 minutes left, you know, throw the ball into Edie, dribble, fake, hook. Okay, fine. Like, you just wasted 25 seconds, and then you're going to set up a press against a team that trots out 4, sometimes 5 ball handlers at once, and especially like a Samson Johnson who is running the court. You know, that's his 2 alley oops. How many times have we seen all year? You take Klingon out, teams kind of get pushed up a little high and start to kind of run you off the line a little bit because, you know, there's not that rim protector. And then just throw it up to Samson Johnson. Like, you have to account for him too. And I don't know if it was like a lack of scouting, like you said, a stubbornness, but a lot of coaches didn't really cover themselves in glory with how they game planned against UConn. Nate Oates being the exception, as always. I'm a huge Nate Oates stockholder. But like Painter had a ton of success getting his guards around the corner off of screens like earlier in the game. And they were using that like chance to get around the corner to then just dump it off into Edie. And he had the dunks or the, you know, had, I think, a lob or, you know, some kind of like baseline mid-range or something like that. And UConn adjusted, obviously, you know, Castle's defense ramped up. They were just a little more active off the ball with helping when UConn's when Purdue's guards got around the corner. But then in the second half, it wasn't like, okay, hey, they're beating us to that spot around the corner. Maybe, you know, keep it around the, you know, movement around the perimeter, you know, to do stuff around the perimeter, make a cut. I didn't see any of that from Purdue. Like, you guys are allowed to move. They just stood around the corner. I don't know enough of, you know, if that was like they didn't have the personnel, they didn't have the confidence, but, you know, coming from covering a team that everyone on that court can dribble, pass, or shoot, it was baffling to see this static, stagnant offense. And look, that's what Purdue was known for. They have Edie, they dump it into Edie, they draw fouls and win. But I'm surprised there was no added wrinkle thrown in there or no in-game adjustments once this UConn team that is like notorious for winning whatever way you want to play. You want a mud, you want a mud fight, here you go. You want to track me, let's run. You know, do you want to have like half court execution and see who can, you know, do that, you know, more efficiently? Fine. There was no adjustment, and this team, the team is too good. Like, the next thing you know, it's 17 points, and Purdue's like, and Painter's like, yeah, all right, I guess that's okay. That happened. They're really good. It's like, dude, come on, man. Like figure something out. Make it a tweak and adjustment. I didn't really see any of that. And I like you went back and watched the game to see like how did that happen? You know, so quickly. It went from being again in the second half, like, okay, 6-point lead, 9-point lead, 13-point lead, 17. Okay, and it's the South Park meme, and it's gone. They're done. It's over. No sense of like adjustment or countermeasures from the other coach, which again is crazy because that's the second best team in the country. That was 1B to a lot of idiotic college basketball pundits out there. And UConn made them look like a JV team in the second half. Like, there are tons of teams out there in the league in college basketball this year that could hang with UConn for a half. It turns out that nobody could put it together for two halves.
Yeah, the decision is kind of reminding me of like a football coach. You're losing by 8 with 4 minutes left, and you've got fourth down. You're in field goal range, and you just kind of kick the field goal. Except Purdue is just kicking the field goal 52 times with every one of those Zach Edey attempts. You know, I think with the stubbornness, maybe it's just that Matt Painter, he runs such a classy program. He's the classiest coach in America. And it's classy to lose games by tiring your best player out and making him ineffective late and not finding a way to let any of your other players shine. That's the mark of a classy program. So I do think, you know, it was going into all these games, you had to respect the opponents that UConn was playing, even Purdue, even though you felt like, you know, UConn is this dominant juggernaut, only team with the good enough metrics offensively and defensively. We all know the defensive metrics would have been higher if Donovan Klingon and Steph Castle were playing healthy all year. But the way that they just went out and executed also, that's the part of this team that kind of supersedes the talent. They had the mental toughness. They kept the edge up throughout. I think about even some signs earlier in the year, like those final two road games of the regular season, that they totally could have taken their foot off the gas there. They did not. They very much did not. They won those games with authority. And, you know, they closed out the season so incredibly strong. And I thought in both of the Bama and Purdue games, at least they took punches. You know, at least it, at least UConn fans felt the mortality of the team a little tiny bit. But look, this was a team that trailed for just over 4 minutes throughout the entirety of the NCAA tournament. That's insane. So to me, it is the best UConn team of all time. It's the most dominant UConn team of all time. 1999 played close games in the NCAA tournament. 2004 played close games in the NCAA tournament. They were not dominating like this. I mentioned it before, what Hurley does. It's very Calhoun-esque. I love the formula. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But these final games were more coronation than anything else because UConn fans never had to face the fear of losing late in the game throughout this run.
And this wasn't a coronation with like against an NC State or a Florida Atlantic. Yeah. They had to play four top 25 KenPom teams and they won by an average of 21 points. I mean, it's, you know, this last year there was a narrative, oh, you didn't have to play Kansas. Oh, Gonzaga stinks. Oh, you had to play Miami. Oh, you didn't play Alabama. Get the fuck out of here with that narrative right now. They blew out everybody and anybody that, you know, and this was the great narrative to leading up to Monday of like, okay, well, finally going to settle Edie versus Klingon. Is it Purdue? Is it UConn? It had been a divide that was narrowing as UConn continued to boat race people earlier, you know, throughout the year, but it was still a divide. It still had some people like, well, I don't know, Edie's really good. And you had those contrarians that just loved kind of like, oh, well, you know, but actually Purdue has, you know, better metrics and everything like that. You know, they got to settle that. And again, Aman, you talked about how they did it. They have, I saw that UConn has had 2 5-stars since 20, I might need to back that up, 2016. And I will give Purdue credit. They don't trot out a lot of 5-stars as well. So it was a testament to two teams that had built programs, one much better and more successful, but it was a great game in the first half because these two teams, you know, had done it the right way. Other stats that I pulled up, UConn for the entire tournament had 118 assists on 188 made field goals. That is a 62.7% rate of basket off of assists. And I think, Amand, you had said that they had trailed for a total of 6 minutes and 22 seconds. I can run a mile in 6 minutes and 22 seconds. No, I can't. I could.
Humble brag.
I mean, what can you say? I'm feeling myself now. It's like it was this cathartic release of like, wow, they actually did that. I have been chirping anybody and everybody in group texts because I was superstitious. You lumped me into the superstition around the UConn program because I was worried that if we started to talk about how historic this team was, that something would happen. And we all said could be historic, like they're heading that way. I think we did a great job hedging our bets. Now that it's over, it's time for us to take our victory lap and talk about as this is like the best college team of all time. I'm prepared to go down that road.
Yeah, I feel like when the three of us talked about it on Slack too, I was saying like the parallels to the 99 championship game heading into this were undeniable. But UConn is 99 Duke and Purdue is 99 UConn, if anyone's still following that. But it's just really incredible how they were able to kind of seal the deal and make this happen. I know I was talking to my wife, my friends, my family about it, and it's like UConn up until last year in 2004 had won these titles where they probably were not the best team in the country. And so just the way the universe works, it would make a lot of sense if things went wrong the 1 year that they were supposed to seal the deal. So I think it just speaks to the way that Hurley has prepared this team. Like I think the infusion of Spencer and Castle kind of eliminated any thoughts of being able to coast or taking the foot off the gas for, to borrow a term from Hurley there. But it's just so impressive that this team really never lost focus all season. I guess you could say the Butler game on the road at Butler, and then they kind of bounced back and took care of business. That was the first inkling for me where I was like, this team has, obviously the talent was always there, but it's like, oh, this team has something else where they can take it to another gear. They can kind of dig deep and bounce back if they get punched in the face. So it's really just an incredible season. It's so hard to describe. And I think it has to be in the discussion for one of the greatest teams in college basketball history. I was looking at KenPom, their adjusted efficiency margin. I believe UConn, this year's UConn team is in like the top five or top three. And that's really the best way, I think, to compare across years and years of college basketball. Obviously, it doesn't go back super far, but, you know, it goes back for UConn's entire six titles. So I feel like that's a pretty good barometer for how teams have been in the modern era of college basketball. So it's incredible. It's crazy that we're having this conversation. I feel like when we talked about this last year, we talked about this year as, you know, potential to be a good team. I don't think this was really in anyone's expectations until like the middle of conference play or through non-conference play this year, where it was like, holy cow, this team is awesome. And they may be even better than last year. It's just really hard to fathom, but it's incredible that it happened.
I think for me, a couple of inflection points. Texas, when it went, when Klingon was, I think he had the flu or something like that. Or I think he was, or just getting exposed, I think, off of Texas's five out offense. And you throw in Samson Johnson, who was like this big unknown, and he puts up, I think, like 18 points. That was like an example of like, wow, again, like just next man up mentality. The inflection point after that was Kansas going toe to toe again, or you know, going toe to toe against Kansas on the road. Cam Spencer on one leg. No Steph Castle, which hindsight's 2020, but we found out how important he is to what they do. No disrespect to Solo Ball, by the way. That was, you know, he performed awesome with Castle being out. And then I think the last one, like you said, was the Butler game, because at that point they were, I think, top five, maybe top seven. I'll have to look that up. But Butler came out, you know, that was, Butler was pretty good at that point. You don't know what the team is going to do in the conference. They had just last January in 2023 gone through that brutal stretch where they lost like what, five of six, and this was on the road, no Klingon. And I was outside that locker room. They were wild after that game. That felt like a huge cathartic moment for the team of thinking like, okay, it doesn't matter who's out, you know, where we're playing, if we're down or not, we're, you know, we're going to figure it out. It was a little bit of, it was a glimpse of the Steph Castle emergence. Caravan took over the first example of like, it can come from anybody. Cause I think that was a big Caravan game. Jalen Stewart hit a three. And from there on out, it was like, all right, this is going to be insane. And I think the final inflection point will be when Klingon came back and they just absolutely steamrolled Creighton, belt to ass, a Creighton team that was really good, had been kind of like the boogeyman for UConn and Hurley, and they absolutely rolled them. Wasn't even sweating like the road loss to Creighton when, you know, they shot like what, 50-60% on the road. And from there on out, it was just like, okay, like down against St. John's, no big deal. Like something's gonna happen. They'll figure it out. And that was the only time I can remember them really like facing a moderate deficit since Alabama. So yeah, I dug through the archives here a little bit. I saw your adjusted efficiency stuff. I think that they were second only to Duke in 2001. I didn't want to go that far back. I didn't even want to go back that far to Kansas, which was third. I'm not counting 2019 Virginia because that's just a fluke. But three teams popped up, not necessarily an adjusted efficiency margin, just more of like eye test being dominant. And that was 2012 UK, that won it all based off Anthony Davis. And you look at that lineup that threw out Terrence Jones, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, Deron Lamb, Anthony Davis, Marcus Teague. That's like that has the similar makeup of this UConn team where you got this rim protector, Kid Gilchrist guarding people on the perimeter, then a bunch of shooters around them with everybody that can kind of dribble and pass and be triple threats. However, as good as that team was, they did not win by the margins that UConn did. And in fact, they also lost the SEC championship to some crappy Vanderbilt team. I mean, you can't consider them goats then, because we're forgetting they won the regular season. They won the Big East. Like they swept every possible award they could have. Going back further to 2009 was a 34-4 North Carolina team that had Hansborough, Larry Drew, Wayne Ellington, Danny Green, Ty Lawson was their big point guard. Again, the balance of having a big guy and a dynamic guard. Oh, Tyler Zeller, I think, was a freshman at that point. But again, they lost to Florida State in the ACC tournament. And as we all know, that was a Jerome Dyson knee injury away from another UConn title. 2009 UConn, I think, was one of the bigger what-ifs when you factor that in. So you can't really include them as well. And then the final one I had was 2018 Villanova, which went 36-4, won it all. They had double-digit victories in all of their NCAA tournaments, and they did win the Big East. So I think that's the closest comparison that I can come up with. And when you look at Jalen Brunson's success in the NBA, Dante DiVincenzo, Michael Bridges, you know, those are three NBA guys surrounded by a lot of like college talent. When you think Amari Spellman, Phil Booth, Eric Pascal, Colin Gillespie, I think that's the closest comparison, and maybe worth a deep dive later to see like to really compare the two. But again, that's in the modern era. We're picking nits at this point as to who's the greatest team of all time. If the pro careers of Klingon and Castle and maybe Caravan or Spencer or Newton are longer than expected or more successful than expected, then you have to kind of factor that in as a narrative as well.
They definitely did. I mean, I think the NBA potential is off the charts for this roster. I wanted to add a few more inflection points to your list there in terms of thinking about moments and times where you knew that this UConn team just had it in so many different waves. I felt the way that they overcame Donovan Klingon's injury and just won all those games. I know it was not the hardest stretch of schedule, but the way they did it, adjusting their strategy, throwing out the smaller lineup a bit more, just making it work, I thought that was really impressive. You mentioned that Creighton home game where Klingon came back. After that, there's a game where Caravan gets hurt against Providence, and that's kind of the Steph Castle offensive breakout game, which I thought was a pretty big moment, which we saw later as Castle led them in scoring against Alabama in the Final Four. And then for me, the really big one is the Marquette win in Hartford on February 17th. That's, you know, you're setting it up, big game of the season, who is for real here? And it was not even a question. You know, they left absolutely no doubt. And then, you know, after that, they lose to Creighton, but their response, like you said, Shorzy, they go, we're never going to lose again. They stomped a totally decent Villanova team that was playing for its NCAA tournament life, and then did the same to Seton Hall in the next game, as well as the two road games that I mentioned. And then, so then at that point, it's, I think this is the best team in the country. It's just a matter of if they do it. Yes, like you said, we know that this team doesn't always win it. The best team doesn't always win it. But again, that was part of their special sauce, was that they also just show up for every game. So I want to talk a little bit more about the experience of being there later, but any other thoughts on just the dominance, the comparisons to other teams? I mean, I think just having this level of dominance in the modern era, portal NIL, as everyone likes to say, doing it without five stars, not that it's, you know, doing it coming out of the AAC, you know, to me, all of that, it builds the case, and I think it's really, really strong for UConn.
Yeah, I think this championship really kind of changed a lot of things. I think last year really threw UConn firmly into that like blue blood debate that we kind of talked about, kind of joked around and jest about. But like this title now is a totally different stratosphere. Like going back to back, six titles in the last 25 years since 1999. All of that stuff, more titles than Duke, more titles than Indiana, as many as UNC, only trailing Kentucky and UCLA, two programs that won a lot of their NCAA championships in a different era for many, many other reasons that we don't need to get into on this pod. But I think it really cements UConn as the greatest basketball program of the 21st century. And it's just an incredible rise to see. And I feel like last year there was that debate, like, is UConn a blue blood? Is it not? Like, there's no history. There's none of this. This run and the way that it went down kind of eliminated all of that. Like, it's not up for debate anymore, at least to me. Obviously, probably a little biased, but I think the facts kind of speak for itself. You know, three coaches, each with at least one title, Calhoun with three, Ollie with one, Hurley now with two. You know, not sustained dominance, just because there's been some gaps, but UConn has put together a really solid resume to be one of the top college programs of the last 25 years. And I think we're going to see it continue to kind of evolve with this back-to-back title run as kind of a springboard. I just feel like with the entire coaching staff coming back now, with Luke Murray, Kamani Young, Tom Moore already saying they're back, it's going to be a huge advantage in the transfer portal on the recruiting trail. Not saying that UConn is going to be landing the top recruits and getting all the best transfers, but I think if players are between two schools, I think it's really easy to sell someone on being like, would you like to play for the defending champions? We have our whole coaching staff back. We know how to win tournament games. We can put you on the map. We can get you to the league. We can do whatever you want. We can get you NIL money. Hurley has done a good job of just kind of getting ahead of the curve with the NIL stuff, with the transfer portal, taking advantage of guys with their COVID years, getting experienced players like Cam Spencer onto the team. It's just so impressive. It's crazy still to think about, like, my parents are telling me stories when we're watching the championship game about watching the games in the field house when they were in college and them getting absolutely pummeled by like Boston College or whatever. And now they're a college basketball juggernaut. And it's just incredible. I'm running out of words to describe it, but I think it's kind of put UConn into a different dimension where they're kind of firmly amongst all those college basketball elite programs. And there's really nothing that anyone could take away from that anymore.
You mentioned your parents telling some stories. I have one that my dad will repeat nonstop in typical parent fashion, but he remembers, you know, he would always play summer leagues or go watch high school summer leagues at Wolf Park, which is, you know, the big park here in Monroe. It's pretty close to Bridgeport, so you get a lot of people coming in there to play. And in Calhoun's early years, he was showing up at Wolf Park in Monroe. He was canvassing every single playground in Fairfield County and across the state to try to find local talent and to dominate his backyard. And to, you know, the how far that, you know, this program has become because of him, because of Kevin Ollie, because of Dan Hurley, is just insane. Of like, you know, I walked around that park earlier in March, and it's like amazing to think that Calhoun was here scouting people for his team because he had to start somewhere. So if you want to talk like really long inflection points, that's one that my parents would always come back to, of like, yeah, we'd always see Calhoun at the park. It's like he would always be talking to Ron Melissa, you know, or the park director and everything like that. And secondly, I think this team has captivated this state for the way they play. And not just the state, but like ball knowers across the country. I have salty, salty UK fans, and we'll get to UK here in a little bit. I have salty Duke fans who are, you know, fans of their respective schools for sure, but they're also, I would classify them as ball knowers, Alabama fans or whatever, like people who I know who have either played or just watch high level stuff and you can have a conversation with. And they're like, this is the most fun team I've ever seen. Like, I don't even hate you guys because you play so well. You play such an unselfish brand of basketball. Everybody's doing stuff on the court. And as it, like, that is, if you want like an elevator pitch to someone who doesn't know ball, tell them that about you. It's like, yeah, everyone's just doing stuff. Like, Klingon's making cuts, Caravan's cutting, there's screens, there's rescreens, there's slips, and it's all this improvisation that is run off of like a couple of baseline sets, whether you think horns or skips or something like that. And because this team is so experienced, when you think Spencer and Newton are on their COVID years and Klingon, you know, was a sophomore and had been through the run last year, Caravan being a redshirt sophomore, Hassan Diarra been trained, you know, they had the experience to kind of use all of this knowledge and to go so deep in the playbook. And the result is just like fun basketball that captivated, I think, a neutral audience, as well as grabbing like the casual portions of Connecticut that just kind of like, okay, yeah, they're really good. And look, the Kemba Walkers and the Shabazz runs are great, but to truly establish yourself, and I'm not talking about Blue Blood, but to truly like let people know you have arrived is to put belt to ass the way that they did this year, and do it in a style that just looks good and doesn't rely on a bunch of, you know, five-star flashy talent. It really has like an old school feel to it that I think, you know, like has its roots. I'm not saying that it's like a Wolf Park roots, but it's the same mentality that Calhoun said of like, all right, I'm going to go canvas the local backyard into like, okay, we're going to, you know, find these dudes who really don't give a shit about stats and aren't on social media. And this is what the result is.
Yeah. I think it also, Patrick, going off what you're saying, it's kind of been a snowball effect. Like, this team has been really good since January, December, really, I mean, since the beginning of the season, but it really picked up steam after that non-conference slate. And I feel like that's kind of allowed the momentum to build and people to kind of hop on the bandwagon, not in a good or bad way, but just as a fact. Like, the casuals, people that really don't tune into the NCAA tournament, maybe they're getting on board earlier. They're rooting for the team. They know the roster. They know Samson's coming in. They're throwing the alley-oops. People are more involved. It allowed people to kind of get more active earlier, I think. And I feel like this title too really captivated the state in a different way, where I feel like the government, like Ned Lamont, the governor, really kind of starting to perk his ears up a little more about what's going on and what UConn can do for the state. And I feel like we've talked about this relationship between UConn and the state in the past and Hartford and everything that goes into it, but some really interesting quotes from Lamont's office this past week where, you know, there was those rumors with Kentucky, and Lamont just comes out and says, we'll do whatever we can. We'll throw money at him to keep him. It's not a problem. I'm not worried about it. 2 days later, 3 days later, Lamont's like, yeah, maybe we should throw some money at renovating Gamble for the back-to-back national champions. I wonder what we can do to kind of help that out, if we can do that. So that's stuff that just wasn't happening before. And it's crazy that it took all this notoriety, like six national titles, for it to get to this point. But it's crazy that it's finally happening. And it seems like the wheels may actually be turning for the state government to be more involved and kind of strengthen that relationship. I feel like they've gone head to head a lot, especially about the stuff in Hartford. So really cool to see that the state is firmly behind this program and the women's program, and willing to continue to be committed to keeping them at this level of excellence.
For sure. I think like the secret sign amongst like ball knowing Connecticut fans or UConn fans was like, oh, right, we're the basketball capital of the world. In these last 2 years, now, like, if you say, like, oh, yeah, I'm from Connecticut, the first thing someone's going to say is, like, oh, wow, you guys are really freaking good. It doesn't matter if they don't know basketball or not. They know. It was on MSNBC. Like, this wasn't just like, oh, hey, a national title. MSNBC spent, like, a five-minute segment. I'm like, wow, that's pretty insane. They just went back-to-back and blew everybody out. And they're recycling the same lines that we've been saying over and over for the last 2 years. So, like, in a weird way, it legitimized a lot of like this, a little bit of, like not arrogance, but like underdog mentality, I think like UConn fans had of like, oh, we have all these titles, we're just as good. Now it's like, well, there's no argument now. It's not just our little secret fun thing of the basketball capital of the world. Truly, like if you are from Connecticut, and I hope this means like youth basketball takes a huge bump in this state, you know, from the grassroots on up, you know, AAU, something like that. Like this is could truly be the start of something special. You think back to 2012 was such a huge missed opportunity, no, for no one's fault of their own. You know, Shabazz just not being ready for being a leader, and Calhoun that being ended up being his last year due to health issues. But they really missed the opportunity to build on some kind of extended dominance. In the same way in 2015 with Rodney Purvis and Boatwright, and then it kind of started the precipitous slide towards what's, you know, the area we don't really want to talk about. It just feels different this year. One, duh, because of back-to-back, but two, because of like the way NIL and the portal works and the way this staff, Hurley, Kamani, Luke, the way they attack things on a daily basis. One, it's inspiring to see how they build a program. I love that article, or I think Hurley had the quote about how he wanted to quit on his first day because it was so bad, and UConn was not up to its first, up to a championship level, and there was so much rot in the foundation. I mean that metaphorically. And Calhoun essentially smacked him in the face, just like, what are you doing? Like, if you're not ready for this, if you don't attack this on a day-to-day basis, you're not the right guy. And that, you know, refocused Hurley, and we see the result now to the point that, like, this is going to be something sustainable. This is going to build something. It doesn't matter that Klingon and Newton and Spencer will be gone, that Castle will be, you know, a potential number one pick in June. It has me excited. I'm no longer like, all right, well, that was a cool run. We're going to be mediocre next, you know, now for a couple of years. I'm, you know, deep in the transfer portal, you know, looking around, seeing who's visiting, trying to figure out like, okay, who can make the jumps. You know, Solo Ball looked really good in December. Jalen Stewart arrived in the Big East tournament. Like, guys, this is something. This is a train that's not stopping.
Absolutely. It's so well set up for the future. And whether or not it's a blue blood or not, I maintain my position from last year and from 2014, which is I do not care. Unless there's some sort of airport lounge that we all get access to as a result of being blue blood fans, it really does not mean anything to me. It's a completely meaningless term.
That sounds really good, though. That sounds cool.
But I will just say this, like, if you're a UConn fan, you can be in your mid-30s and have a active memory of six national championship games, watching them on TV. You're not claiming anything that occurred during segregation or, you know, like the three-point line or the shot clock being invented.
Or one shining moment.
What about one shining moment? Sure. I think the shot clock and the three-point line are maybe more relevant innovations. But it's, you know, like I just – it's – if anyone else wants to come at that, they can tell me about how many they have seen in their lifetime. And that's really the thing. And then, yeah, it's who cares about the past, especially the really deep past. UConn's got a great recent history and a tremendously bright future. Dan Hurley is there, the Big East, they're set up, they've got money. And, you know, again, to talk about whose blood is what color or what matters, Kentucky just made the strongest play it possibly could, offered a football coach salary to Dan Hurley, and Dan Hurley said no. He said, my situation's better, my job's better, and my wife would not let me move to Kentucky no matter what, even if I wanted to. So there. So UConn just did, you know, held off the largest college, you know, competitor for that job that it possibly could. It doesn't, you know, again, I don't care for the moniker. It doesn't really matter. I don't know what else you could want as a fan and observer of the team. They've won two championships in a row. They're holding on to their coach forever. And the guy just said no to Kentucky. Like, if you were telling yourself that this was happening, you'd be like, ha ha ha, nice fan fiction. You know, like this would be embarrassing boneyard fan fiction if someone wrote that this was going to happen and it's gone, you know, again, even better than expected. Incredible.
Listen, are we on the Kentucky portion now?
Yes,
I'm gonna try
we're
to
on Kentucky.
I'm gonna try to do this while laughing because it is I'm so messed up in the head that I had more fun scrolling Twitter in the last day than I did after Monday or after Saturday or after any number of our belt to ass moments in the last 2 years, because I have a lot of Kentucky connections. I went to school down there. I've been inundated with this Lexington, University of Kentucky, we're the creme de la creme, it's Kentucky bullshit for now going on 16 years. And to see the work coming for your coach, wait till we see the bag that we throw at Dan Hurley. Mitch Barnhart is, we're tracking the flight and it landed in LaGuardia. That's only a couple of hours to Hartford. First of all, dipshits, it's not 2 hours to Hartford. Get a map and come back and see me. Anyway, they're looking up. Oh, this guy's meeting with a guy who works for Hurley's agent. That was a speaking arrangement, you dipshits. It was the funniest thing. I have not stopped laughing like the Joker since officially it was broken that there was a 0% chance. And was I scared? No, because that's not who Hurley is. That's not the guy we've been covering for the last 5 or 6 years. And the arrogance to assume that you can just throw money and that Kentucky is a better program than UConn right now. Send it all back. Kentucky is a has-been. You hire Mark Pope. You end up with Mark Pope. Are you serious? Like, what are we doing? I'm sorry. Every time it comes up, I can't. I just, it's the funniest thing I've ever heard. Amon, get ready to learn Indiana, buddy, because, oh my God. And then to retract, to move the goalposts and say, oh, well, it was never really going to happen anyway. Like, we were never going to do that. Or, like, he was never, like, I guess Matt Jones at one point in his consistent efforts to move the goalposts back. So it was just like, well, I guess it was like he wanted, like, other things. Yeah. Like national championships. And to then assume, like, oh, it's like, oh, well, you guys are really mean. Well, I thought there weren't enough fans, which, by the way, I can't wait to see that the attendance at Mark Pope's presser later this weekend. I'm sure that'll be really great. I'm looking for pictures there. I might even go down there myself. It's an hour and 10 minute drive.
Do it.
I'm gonna go and show up and just take pictures. Like, wow, look at all the fans here. Then to like say like, oh, well, you fans, like, you guys are really mean. You're the ones that are so distorted from reality that you just think that you can toss a bag at a coach. Has the SEC diluted your brain so much that you think the world revolves around money? We have some standards here. Those standards are 1, 6 rings, and 2, building something that can last more than one national championship since 2012. And get them out of here. I am so sick of Kentucky fans. You know, I had actually grown to like them in the last 15 years or so. But there has been zero recognition of like where that program is. And I had previously not liked Louisville fans for being a little arrogant, but they've been through it. I feel bad. You know, they have said, look, we stink. We have to get, you know, a Pat Kelsey to get us back to where we are. They recognize the path that they had to take. Kentucky, on the other hand, just thinks that they can throw money on the flashiest name out there, which happens to be UConn at this point, and assume all their problems are done. I am so tired of that fan base. I am so happy that this broke the way it has, because it confirms everything I have been saying for the last 15 years, that Kentucky is a joke.
Yeah, I never was really concerned about Kentucky swooping in. I just feel like for all the flack that people give Benedict or the state of Connecticut or UConn in general, they know where their bread is buttered. And I feel like they're going to pony up and give Hurley a contract that's maybe not in that Kentucky, you know, Nick Saban money stratosphere, but something really close and something that makes it, you know, so he's rewarded for staying here and winning back-to-back titles. But I also just I never saw Hurley as a culture fit there either. I think Hurley wants to build a program, and it seems like at least under Cal, Kentucky was really committed to that kind of one and done strategy. So it just never really made a lot of sense. If it was somewhere else, maybe it would be a different story. And I come back to something that someone that I know told me. They're close-ish with Woj, who's a good friend of Dan Hurley. And before Hurley came to UConn, my friend asked Woj, "What do you think about the UConn job?" And Woj told him, "Danny Hurley's been gunning for this job. This is Danny Hurley's dream job. This is all he wants to do is coach UConn." And a lot of things have happened since then. A lot of really good things have happened since then. But I still believe that that's the case. And it seems like if Hurley's not going to leave for a Kentucky or a comparable program at the college level, he's probably not going anywhere for a long time. So that stability, that ability to kind of keep things rolling, keep things moving along, is going to pay huge dividends in the portal, on the recruiting trail for years to come. And I think that's why we're talking about this three-peat, right? That's crazy talk. It's insane that we're just throwing this around like it's nothing. But there are some things that are happening now, and there's enough kind of a foundation built where it's not impossible. I will say it's incredibly unlikely, but we could be here a year from now and be like, hey, they were pretty close, and that's a feat in itself. So it's exciting to see how it played out, but I never really put a lot of stock into those reports just because I feel like it would have had to be more than just money for Hurley to move because things are rolling so well right now. There's no sense in leaving when you're on top.
Absolutely. I took zero serious in that. Yeah, go ahead.
The first toothless hillbilly that spent, a fortune on Rupp season tickets instead of, I don't know, health insurance or something like that, that is chirping Hurley after a loss to like Tennessee or something like that. Dan Hurley has like publicly, now this I think it's a little embarrassing, but it's like has like tried to fight fans before, like, come on down here, you're gonna get hurt. And stuff like that. Like, do you think he's going to handle like a Kentucky person like that? And to go back to the money, he's, I think, just crossed 50, right? And at this point, like, what do you need that exorbitant amount of money for? When you're already going to go back to the table, thank you, Kentucky. You just got him paid and locked him up for us. You're going to go back to the table and probably take home north of 10 mil a year. Like, what else do you need at that point? And like Dan said, that like they have a chance to build something incredibly special here. Maybe not, a back to back to back, but if they make a Final Four or a Sweet 16 or take home a Big East crown, it builds the narrative of like, man, UConn's always going to be there. It doesn't matter what happens, they're going to find a way. And I'm ready to dive into that now if you guys want. I've cooled off from my Kentucky stuff. I'm ready to look forward.
Well, I just wanted to add that, yeah, I mean, Dan Hurley was asked about it right after the national championship game, and he laughed. His immediate response was to laugh. And at that point, I mean, and then he said, "Ask my wife." He literally said that, So I think at that point, there was no need to even take it really as seriously as maybe some section of nervous people wanted to do. But I did enjoy Kentucky, like missing out on options number 2, 3, 4, and 5 after talking such a big game about being able to, to recruit a guy to hire Dan Hurley, to hire Billy Donovan, to miss out on Nate Oates, who I was saying, I was like, look, I don't think Nate Oates is going to leave for this. And
Because they
it's a bad situation.
see how the fan base treats Cal, who, look, I know he has his warts, but he brought in all of the shiny things that you wanted. Did he work with them well? Yeah, not necessarily, but like you ran a very well-respected guy in the coaching ranks out. Why would someone go in there for the, like, oh, well, we have money. Cool, man. Great. Then go put it on Wall Street. Go place another horse bet because it ain't for you. It does not mean more in the SEC when it comes to basketball.
My favorite thing with the Kentucky folks online was someone was saying how they had history because they were in that movie Glory Road, which if you've ever seen Glory Road, Kentucky is not the protagonist in that movie. No spoilers, but they are not the good guys. So
I was shocked at how stuff. I was shocked at how dumb and not ball knowing that their fan base was. And I had spent a good portion of my time being like, yeah, you know what? They're really passionate. They know their stuff. No, they're really passionate. One of them even said, oh, well, Dan Hurley probably didn't want to come here because he's not Christian and an atheist wouldn't have worked here. What? Like that? Are you not paying attention at all? Is he as religious as Scott Drew? Apparently God told him to stay in Waco and Buck Lexington, but like, it's just like there was such a large gap of knowledge from a lot of like blue check Kentucky reporters of like, what are you guys doing? You don't know anything.
So, blue check is now a man who's purchased it. And, a lot of these people were people who are deeply entrenched in the athletic department and, honestly, similar to us, right? They're how people from the outside perceive us, which we know a lot about. Sometimes they don't always take our reporting or opinions as seriously. You say, oh, that's a Kentucky Rivals guy. So of course he's going to say that. But in this case, it's extremely true because they were doing a tremendous amount of cope, a tremendous amount of spin, being like, oh yeah, they're really close. Should be in 2 days. I want to tell you something. Again, been doing this kind of work for a little while. Pull the curtain back a bit. If you say something's going to happen in 2 days and it doesn't happen, there are no consequences for that. There are literally no consequences for that. So you just go do it. You go be Matt Jones. You go be Justin Rowland. You go say, this is happening. I think this is happening in 2 days. My favorite cope that I saw was people like posting Kentucky's tax rate compared to, the state of Connecticut's tax rate. And it's like, it doesn't matter, man. It doesn't matter. It can be a $20 million contract. He's going to get run out of there in 24 months or less because he can't survive there versus the lifetime contract he has basically already secured at UConn. But Dan Hurley has the Jim Calhoun already locked up. He's got an office in Gamble for life already. I guarantee you this. So there's just no, Dan Hurley's got good financial advisors. I think he said literally as much, look, man, I'm paraphrasing and I'm making it sound cooler. He knows how to say things well. Don't say that Dan Hurley said this. But, he's like, look, I make $5 million right now. What is seven? What is eight? Like I'm a multi-millionaire. You're not going to change my life.
It's
and
not
by the
bad.
Way, this is going to be temporary. So he's got good advisors. He knows the situation, but and no one should have taken it seriously. That's the thing, from the Monday after the national championship game to yesterday, yesterday, Thursday, the 11th, there should not have, when we got confirmation, 0% chance. There should not have been any worries about UConn. That was just, text message. That's, you're nervous. You're a nervous person. You want to find something to be nervous about in an extremely good situation. UConn has won two in a row. It has Dan Hurley. They have the Big East. They have everything possible to keep this run going. The recruiting is going well. People are going to want to join Dan Hurley's team. We do not have enough time on this podcast to discuss the roster. We'll have to do that in a separate episode of the Fast Break. We'll maybe start doing them a little bit more quickly. We've got a lot to talk about here, a lot going on. We could probably do an entire hour on the potential roster and portal recruiting, who stays, who goes, NBA draft stuff. I will say, very exciting to see where Donovan Clingan and Steph Castle are appearing on draft boards. Kentucky basketball, welcome to your future as Auburn football or Indiana basketball at best. Patrick, what do you got? Take us home here.
For the record, the final alley-oop is Madigan and I sat on this pod, I think either in the summer or in the fall, and said, if UConn goes back-to-back, Clingan and Castle are going to be top five picks and that's where they're projected in mocks now. So, and I would just like to, you know, again, underscore our ball knower credentials going forward. So,
You also called Cam Spencer committing to UConn half Christmas, which turned out to be, quite prescient. I
yeah,
would
that was sick.
recommend everyone check out that first podcast of the season. We were spot on in a lot of different ways. I'm going to go through the whole podcast run, relive the season via our podcast. I recommend you all do the same, Husky fans. Our takes are tremendous. The Fast Break Pod folks, please do tell your friends. We've had a blast running this thing. I'll just share also again a little bit more inside baseball. We have our newsletter platform on Beehive, the UConnFastBreak.beehive.com, but we also have this podcast operating off of a Substack, and we've been growing subscribers on both. So thank you all. We've just kind of been running our Substack as our podcast platform. Thank you all for subscribing to that. We've been super encouraged by the audience growth, by people responding to us, and by the numbers of people who are subscribing on iTunes and Substack to just this podcast. We're going to maybe work on consolidating some of that in the future, but just wanted to thank everyone for listening. Please do let us know if you have any thoughts, anything you'd like to see covered on the pod. That is going to do it for us today. We're going to hop back on soon to talk about the roster. Thank you all for listening.